From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Most people know Buck Henry as a frequent guest host on Saturday Night Live. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we hear about that and about some of Henry's behind-the-scenes accomplishments, like writing the screenplay for The Graduate and co-creating the TV spy spoof Get Smart. Also today, we meet British crime writer Ruth Rendell. Rendell writes psychological thrillers exploring the nature of evil. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward answers the question, did the blues die in the 1960s? And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of the poet Allen Ginsberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The State Department said today 42 Panamanian dissidents were brought to the United States for protection over the weekend after last week's aborted coup in Panama. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said family members of Major Moises Giroldi, who is said to have led the failed assault on General Manuel Noriega, were among those given refuge. In a related development, the Bush administration came under heavy criticism for initially telling reporters the United States was not involved in the failed attack, then admitting later its military forces blocked two roads at the rebels' request. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said President Bush will accept the invitation by leaders of Peru, Bolivia, and Colombia to meet for a drug summit. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has details from the White House.
Talking to reporters, Fitzwater pointed out that President Bush brought up the need for a drug summit with Latin American leaders during last year's campaign. Fitzwater says the president is glad to note that the Andean presidents share his view and is looking forward to working with them in fighting the drug battle. Although President Bush had publicly talked about having such a summit, he had made no specific proposal. Fitzwater said the specific proposal made by the Latin American leaders will be studied and issues concerning timing, location, and agenda items will be worked out. He indicated that President Bush is open to going wherever the Latin American leaders decide to hold the summit. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Alleged drug trafficker Evaristo Foras Ardia has been sentenced to 14 years imprisonment by Colombian Supreme Court. More bombs went off overnight as the war against Colombia's drug mafia continues. The administration of the Bogota Daily, El Expedore, says the cartel's capital, Medellin, has been assassinated, and Simon Fisher reports from Bogota.
Evaristo Foras is alleged to be the highest-ranking trafficker captured so far in the Colombian government's anti-drug offensive. Foras was deported to Colombia from neighboring Ecuador 10 days ago, but does not face drugs charges in Colombia. He was sentenced on arms charges dating back to 1984, apparently to avoid releasing him today after the period of detention under emergency powers expired. One cartel gang member was killed by police in the capital, Bogota, after placing one of 11 bombs which exploded overnight. In Medellin, the administrator of the newspaper which has campaigned most strongly against the drug cartels was murdered. Last month, a bomb destroyed the paper's Bogota offices. Meanwhile, the government has rejected accusations in a report by the human rights organization Amnesty International that the Colombian armed forces are implicated in some 2,500 political killings over the past 17 months. For National Public Radio, I'm Simon Fisher in Bogota.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 6 points to close at 2785.33. Declines led advances 8-7. This is NPR News. A report in this week's edition of Aviation Week in Space Technology says secret reconnaissance satellite launched by the Space Shuttle Columbia in August malfunctioned and may be tumbling in orbit. The magazine says astronomers in 7 countries have been observing the apparent tumbling motion since mid-August. It said photographs of the spacecraft taken for Aviation Week by astronomers showed brilliant flashes of light from the satellite every second, characteristic of a payload rotating out of control and reflecting the sun as it tumbles. No comment from the military. The bodies of 4 men believed to be El Salvadorans were discovered this morning on the back of a trailer about 100 miles southwest of Houston. Police are searching for another group believed to have survived and escaped. Bruce Dorton of member station KUHF reports from Houston.
The grim discovery was made about 9:15 by a brakeman who saw the trailer door open and radioed to the car inspector, who discovered one body. A further search turned up 3 others. Victoria Police Lieutenant Jack Williams says the men apparently died of asphyxiation. An autopsy will be performed. Williams says the men haven't been positively identified, but there are indications they may have come from El Salvador.
A couple of IDs that we have found, either in the box or on the bodies, indicate this.
Williams says it appears another group of men was traveling in a separate trailer. A search is underway for them. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Houston.
A Nicaraguan diplomat today accused armed anti-Sandinista rebels of crossing from Honduras into Nicaragua in violation of a Central American accord calling for their demobilization. During a news conference, Nicaraguan Ambassador Francisco Lacayo said the armed infiltration raises doubts about the commitment of the Honduran government to respect the accord. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry said today Egypt will consult with the PLO before formulating its response to a U.S. invitation to join Israel in a three-way Middle East peace conference. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Buck Henry has been a frequent guest host of Saturday Night Live, and although he seemed perfectly in sync with the humor of the not-ready-for-primetime players, his work had already made it to primetime. He wrote for The Steve Allen Show, The Gary Moore Show, and co-created the spy spoof Get Smart. Henry also wrote the screenplays for The Graduate, Catch-22, and What's Up, Doc, and he co-directed the remake of Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty. You can see his latest work this month on the PBS comedy series Trying Times. It's an anthology about contemporary life with the emphasis on neurosis, despair, and hopelessness. Buck Henry directed the premiere episode Hunger Chic. Carrie Fisher and Griffin Dunn star as a self-absorbed yuppie couple preparing for dinner guests. Their daughter likes to watch a TV show that raises funds for starving children in Africa, but Carrie Fisher is afraid the show will detract from her perfect dinner party. Buck Henry plays the host of the TV show.
Little Abdul lives in a world without cash machines, VCRs, credit cards.
Jennifer, if I've told you once, I've told you a thousand times, do not watch this show.
Why can't I watch it?
Because I said so.
It's not a reason.
You want a reason? Fine, I'll give you a reason. You see that little boy there?
His name is Abdul.
Well, he used to live in a nice big apartment just like you, and his mommy told him not to watch the starving children show. But he didn't listen to his mommy, just like you don't listen to me. So one day, when little Abdul was once again disobeying his mother, that evil man right there reached from inside the TV, grabbed little Abdul, and took him off to starving children's land. And if you're not careful, the exact same thing is going to happen to you.
Now, you play the host in this of one of those syndicated Feed the Starving Children in Africa shows, and the phone number is 1-800-STARVE.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to know why you gave yourself that part, and also I'd like to know if you've watched a lot of these shows on TV.
The Starve shows?
Yeah.
Well, answering your questions in reverse order.
Yes.
Yeah, I have watched a lot of them. I particularly like the guy in the sort of Banana Republic suit that strides through the desert. The person I'm trying to be, in effect.
Yeah.
He's very well tailored and very concerned, and I really seriously doubt that very many people go to bed any less hungry because he's out there. It's a fascinating phenomenon of, that thing about first world, third world relationship through television, through a medium screen, part of which I think is what the show is about. So in answer to your question, yeah, I watch those guys. I want to see them eaten by wild animals when they're out there walking around in the desert. I cast myself, one, because they asked me to play it, because they're extremely cheap. And there I was, another, a body with a SAG card on the set. Why not do it? And of course, because I'm greedy.
Uh-huh. And this episode of Trying Times called Hunger Chic, which is directed by Buck Henry, is the premiere episode, and it will be on in mid-October on public television stations. Now, I want to ask you about your name. I think you were given the name Buck Henry Zuckerman.
Mm-hmm.
Buck doesn't sound like a very Jewish name to me.
But, weirdly enough, I was christened and confirmed in the Episcopalian Church.
Ah, Zuckerman sounds like a Jewish name to me.
It sounds like one to me, too. And my grandfather's nickname was Buck, so they gave it to me.
So
my uncle This is one of the non-lies I'm telling you.
Okay.
My uncle, Harvey Zuckerman, was an Episcopalian minister. Go figure.
Oh, so a lot of people must have had a mistaken impression about your religious identity.
Actually, by the time I was in one of my college years, I figured out that the reason I was so phenomenally acceptable socially is because my Jewish friends thought I was Jewish and my Christian friends assumed I was Christian. Some from my name, some from my face.
Now, you were in the Army. What year did you go in the Army?
1950, the end of 1952.
Okay, now, you were in the 7th Army Repertory Company and toured with a musical comedy that you wrote and directed?
Ultimately, yeah.
Was this the beginning of your show business career?
No, it was the end of my Army career.
Well,
no, I had acted as a kid. I toured with Life with Father when I was about 16.
Oh.
15 or 16, on what was then called the subway circuit. It doesn't exist any longer. It was one of the great New York theatrical traditions. A company that sent shows out to all the suburbs, theaters, wonderful legit theaters that then existed in the Bronx and Brooklyn and Long Beach, and ultimately went, I think, as far as New Jersey and Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But it ain't there any longer. We rehearsed the play in the basement of a movie theater on 42nd Street, a theater that was famous for showing foreign films. Foreign films in those days, of course, meant films in which women appeared with their clothes off.
Right.
And so we were rehearsing in the basement next to the gentleman's room. So it was interesting to be rehearsing this sort of all-American play and have guys wandering in and out, their raincoats loose, going up and down from, well, you get the picture.
Right. Buck Henry is my guest. After you got out of the Army, you launched this elaborate con, really, called CINNA.
The Society for Indecency to Naked Animals.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make any sense, does it?
No.
Well, it doesn't.
You explain it.
I can't. I only partly invented this. A friend of mine named Alan Abel, who has since become known as a kind of general American hoaxer, developed this notion. We were sitting around one day in a kind of ecstasy of unemployment and thought, well, it's time the American public congealed their attitudes about naked animals. So we invented this guy who I became, G. Clifford Prout Jr., who toured the country, well, not toured exactly, but popped up here and there, talking about the indecency of nudity in the animal kingdom and how it was resulting in juvenile delinquency and alcoholism and suicide in the American public.
And animals should be clothed.
They should be clothed at all times. I went around condemning zoos as the burlesque houses of the animal world and stuff like that. And, of course, a lot of people took it quite seriously, I'm proud to say.
Well, let me say that I happen to have the CINNA theme song on our turntable, so I'm going to give it a spin.
I'm thrilled.
Here we go.
High on the wings of CINNA, we fight for the future now. Let's clothe every pet and animal, whether dog, cat, horse, or cow. G. Clifford Prout, our president, he works for you and me. So clothe all your pets and join the march for worldwide decency. S-I-N-A.
You wrote the lyrics to that, right?
That's not me.
No, and that's not you singing.
That's Alan Abel, I think.
Right.
Because my voice is infinitely better, and I always accompany myself on the ukulele.
I don't think you're on this record.
No, of course not. What record is it?
It's called Inside CINNA.
I never heard of it. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
I didn't know it existed.
Yeah.
I think I did write the lyrics. I think I wrote the song, but I'm not sure. Alan may have...
I think you wrote it because it's attributed to Prout, the president of CINNA, which is you.
I've never made a dime off it, but it's a thing about idealism anyway. It doesn't matter.
What social attitudes of the time were you playing off of? Were there decency groups that you were particularly trying to lampoon with the society for indecency to naked animals?
Yes, there were. There were. It was generated out of some kind of attention to a move for censorship of something, but I can't remember specifically what it was. Of course, it's perfectly applicable now. Keep Jesse Helms clothed and hooded, or some movement like that.
So anyways, you went on talk shows as if this were for real?
Mm-hmm.
And who took you seriously? How far did you get?
I got pretty far. I think, well, it started on the Today Show. Garraway, I think, understood what it was about, but he always kept a straight face. Ultimately, it ended up, years later, every couple of years, something would happen, and someone would ask me to appear as G. Clifford Prout. Finally, around 1961, I did an interview for CBS News from the Griffith Park Zoo in Los Angeles, and I sang the Cinna Marching song and was yammering on about naked yaks and stuff, and it went back east. I drove back east. By the time, 5 days later, when I got to New York, I found out that Walter Cronkite was not very happy because he had presented this as the last piece on the national news as a real thing. And then somebody said, no, look, see, we know who he is. Mm. And he was quite angry with the reporter who developed the story and with everyone around. I don't blame him. It never occurred to me that that would happen.
Do you think that Cinna helped your career? It got you a lot of publicity. It got you on national TV, but not as yourself.
Oh, no, not in the slightest. Nor did I really ever intend it to. I don't think it did anything except possibly make a few people leery of me when they knew who I was.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more.
All right.
My guest is Buck Henry, and he has directed the opening episode of the PBS comedy series Trying Times, and that will be on in mid-October. He also wrote the screenplays for The Graduate and Catch-22, co-directed Heaven Can Wait, and has been a frequent guest host on Saturday Night Live. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Buck Henry is my guest. You co-created Get Smart with Mel Brooks.
True.
How did you come up with the idea? Do you remember the night or the day when the idea first came to you?
Well, it really came, I think, to Danny Melnick, who was one of the producers. And it was a year in which both Inspector Clouseau and James Bond were among the hottest properties in, hottest characters in the world. And I think it was Danny who said, think about James Bond and think about Clouseau and see if it makes sense. And, of course, it immediately did. And that was basically the genesis of it.
Did you ever steal plot ideas for the spy spoof Get Smart from straight TV shows?
We tried to, but they got so twisted in the stealing that it was hard to figure out what we were stealing from. By the second year, I would do anything. You know, I used to watch Mission Impossible, I think was the main one I watched, to try and steal an idea. But when you tried to analyze their plots, they seemed so outrageously foolish that that we'd have to back up for our own silliness from them. We had a team of terrific writers who were very good at developing lunatic notions.
In 1968, I think it was, the film The Graduate came out, and you wrote the screenplay for that,
mm-hmm.
adapted from the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to play what's become the most famous passage of dialogue from the movie, and then ask you how you wrote it.
Okay.
Here we go.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
Exactly how do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
Enough said. That's a deal.
Well, for our listeners who haven't seen The Graduate lately or who've never seen it, I should mention that Dustin Hoffman just came home from college, from out-of-town college, and all of his parents' friends are there, and they're all giving him useless advice on how he should spend the rest of his life. So getting back to the plastics suggestion, mm-hmm. this was your line, right?
It was.
Yeah. So
you mean if I'd have used the word linoleum, I'd be cleaning streets today.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was suggesting.
It's probably true.
But plastics really did have resonance. I think that for young people who went to see the movie, it was just this perfect example of the most boring, impossible profession you could ever get into, exactly what you didn't want to be doing when you came home from college.
Yeah, well, that's actually, the word had by then already, had already come to mean that, in a sense. You know, plastic, I can't remember what the noun would be that would attach to it when it was used as an adjective, but like, you know, tin can democracy, plastic living, ersatz stuff. It already was something of a cliche in the, certainly in the academic world, that the word plastic meant everything that everyone feared was happening to a too rich, too smug, too happy country. And it's good to say plastics has a good ring to it. The odd thing is I had a conversation with Nichols before he started shooting, and I said, I think maybe plastics is a little old-fashioned. Let me see if I can find a word that's more up-to-date. Fortunately, I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Were there elements of the story of The Graduate that you related to yourself?
Yeah, and I wasn't the only one. Larry Turman, who produced it, and Mike Nichols, who directed it, and I all were about the same age. We'd all come out of various prep schools and colleges, and we all related to that. Sure, I think, and almost everybody did. That's what kept those kids coming.
So you related to the idea of coming home and having your parents' generation give you advice you couldn't use and try to retake control over your life?
Yeah, but I think it's probably, you know, it happened to be particularly relevant, or seemed to be particularly relevant to that generation, even though we, Nichols, Turman, I, and others connected with it, were writing essentially from a sort of 50s sensibility. It made sense to the 60s generation. So I suspect that that sense of, I'm afraid we're going to have to call it alienation, is something that happens, you know, every 10 or 15 years to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Buck Henry is my guest. I want to skip ahead to Saturday Night Live. Do you hold the record for guest hosting the program?
I used to. I think I hold the record for a number of hosts in small number of years, but I think Steve Martin has beat me finally.
Ah, okay.
I did 10 in the first 5 years.
Let me ask you about some of the characters that you played. One of them was Uncle Roy, the dirty uncle babysitter who mm-hmm. used to sit the two girls on his lap, and what was it, Gilda Radner and Lorraine Newman?
Yeah, he was a sort of a fond uncle child molester.
Right.
Now, a lot of people think you can't do comedy about that sort of stuff, but the fact is that you can.
How did you get this part? Did you write it?
No. What always interests me when excoriating letters come in is that it was written by the two of the female writers. It was written by Ann Beats and Rosie Schuster, who invented the character, handed it to me on a silver platter, and wrote all of them. I can't remember whether we did two or three, but Anne and Rosie wrote them with enormous affection and a tumultuous laughter. I mean, they loved the character, so how could I not? And I mean, the secret to it being that the little girls loved the guy. The secret to it being also that they weren't really little girls. I mean, they were Lorraine and Gilda, but they were little girls. I mean, it was all very ambivalent on mm-hmm. on an odd sexual level. But it used to get a lot of nasty mail. The other, I had a rationalization for it, though, even after, even if somebody did make me feel guilty. My rationalization was that when I looked in the into the camera at the end of one or two of them and said, oh, don't worry, honey, you're not alone, there are Uncle Roys everywhere, or something like that, is I had this rationalization, which might be thought of as a fantasy, that there were thousands of little girls, little boys, or someone turning, you know, to look at some member of their family watching the show with them and saying, oh, yeah, yeah, there is. There's one here, Dad, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think the number of times that you hosted Saturday Night Live is an example of how your humor has bridged several generations, and I think that that's something that can't always be said of humorists. Like, some humorists see the absurdity around them in the immediate generation that they grew up with.
You mean,
and don't get beyond that? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? They don't.
They get old and dull.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. No, but you know what I mean.
And the jokes aren't funny, and the attitudes are decayed.
Well, some people, that they're still making jokes that might have been funny 20 years mm-hmm. ago, but that don't work anymore. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that ever happened with you.
That's why, that's why I kept from being a stand-up comic.
What do you mean that's why you kept from being a stand-up
comic?
Well,
if you stay away from, if you sort of attack from the outside, stand-up comics have a really tough row to hoe. They got to stand right in there in the middle of the, you know, when the Indians are circling and sort of shoot what few bullets they have left. You either fight from inside the wagons, or you ride around the wagons with the Indians and shoot in. And now I feel that you should be way outside the Indians, lurking in the mountains behind a rock with a howitzer, preferably. And that's as far as I'm going to go.
Okay. What kind of projects are you working on now?
I'm in the middle of a film script. I'm going to start rehearsing a play in a few weeks here in New York. That's all I can remember.
You know what I never understand about people who are in film or television? What do you do in between projects when there isn't a show or a movie for a few weeks or for a few months?
Most actors suffer. A lot of writers just keep writing. I'll do anything to get the in-betweens. I love the in-betweens. I travel. I mean, I'm about to leave town and go on a trip. I'll go to any country. I'll do anything. I'll do any excuse not to work.
Okay. Thank you a lot for talking with
us. Hey, my pleasure.
Buck Henry directed the premiere episode of the PBS comedy series Trying Times. It's called Hunger Chic, and it stars Griffin Dunn, Carrie Fisher, and Denitra Vance. It will be shown on PBS stations in mid-October. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, novelist and gay activist Armistead Maupin. He'll discuss how his life and the lives of his straight and gay characters have changed since the mid-70s, when he started his series of comic novels, Tales of the City. He's just completed the final book in the series. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ruth Rendell is one of England's most popular detective writers. Coming up, she reveals how she writes her surprise endings. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward updates the story of the blues. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of the poet Allen Ginsberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A court ruling was announced in Washington this evening that clears the way for a Thursday launch at Cape Canaveral. A judge denied a request by anti-nuclear activists to ground the mission and its nuclear power payload for safety reasons. Meanwhile, engineers reported a problem today on one of the three main engines in the space shuttle Atlantis that could delay blastoff of the space probe to Jupiter for a week. The South African government has announced it will release 8 long-term political prisoners, including Walter Sisulu, the second most senior jail political leader. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Sisulu and 7 others, most of them serving life sentences that began in the early 1960s, will be released unconditionally as soon as the formalities are completed. President F.W. de Klerk said in his announcement that this could take some time. He also said that the releases had been discussed with Nelson Mandela, and that Mandela confirmed that his own release was not yet on the agenda. The timing of the announcement strengthens de Klerk's hand before his first meeting with Archbishop Desmond Tutu and other critics tomorrow. The release of Sisulu is being taken as a dry run for Mandela. Sisulu will be the first leader with a large national following to come out, and his movements will be carefully watched for signs of how the public will respond when Mandela himself is released later. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
A 2-month-old rail blockage of the Soviet Republic of Armenia appears to be ending. The Soviet government says shipments of food and other goods are now moving on rail lines, and deliveries of fuel, now in desperately short supply, may resume tomorrow. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The easing of the blockade at least temporarily ends a political impasse that prompted threats from Moscow to use troops to get the rail lines working again. Azerbaijani rail workers enforced the blockade to pressure Armenians to drop a territorial claim to Nagorno-Karabakh, a largely Armenian region now ruled by Azerbaijan. Rail shipments resumed over the weekend, although the Azerbaijanis continued to withhold fuel, desperately needed to transport other goods throughout Armenia. Azerbaijani nationalists who organized the blockade said tonight they have agreed to let fuel shipments resume, but their decision will have no effect on Nagorno-Karabakh, also the target of blockades that have forced the Soviet government to begin airlifting in food and other supplies. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
According to Kabul Radio, rebel forces hit the capital of Afghanistan today, killing over 20 people. A number of people were wounded by 5 surface-to-surface missiles fired into residential areas. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 6 points to close at 2,785.33 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says he started listening to the blues at a time when the blues were supposed to be dead, but that didn't stop him.
In the 60s, when I was discovering blues, the story pretty much went like this. Blues had moved from its acoustic beginnings in the South to become an urban music in Chicago after the Second World War. In the hands of people like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Otis Rush, Sonny Boy Williamson, and Little Walter, it had become a genuinely popular music, but the rise of vocal groups and rock and roll had relegated this music to obscurity. Blues was still around, but it was a specialist music no longer popular with black people. And from the evidence, that's just what it looked like, too. After all, Muddy Waters hadn't had a hit since the mid-50s, and neither had any of those other guys. It was like somebody'd pulled the plug in 1956, and here I was developing a taste for this stuff almost 10 years later. In fact, it was on a snowy day in 1966 that I turned on the radio, a New York City station no less, and heard this. Well, no way that wasn't blues. It was a guy I was embarrassed to say I'd never heard of, Slim Harpo. The Rolling Stones knew about him. They'd recorded his song King Bee. And when I went out and bought Scratch My Back, I discovered something very interesting. It was on Excello Records out of Nashville. The blues hadn't died. They'd just moved back down south. Even in Memphis, where Stax Records was putting out what I considered the state-of-the-art in soul music, they were also putting out blues records that were being bought by a lot of the same people. The trouble was, there was sort of a gap between black fans who listened to blues and those who didn't. Some guys I worked with the summer after I graduated from high school derided it as that old Caledonia-fied stuff, fit only for their grandmothers to listen to. But not 5 years later, I was in Memphis when a bunch of girls much younger than they would have been burst into a record store I was visiting, screaming, "Is it here yet?" I was puzzled, so I asked the guy behind the counter what was happening. "They're looking for the new Little Milton record," he said.
"If I don't love you, baby, grits ain't grocery, eggs ain't poultry, and Mona Lisa was a man." And run off through the jungle fighting lions with the switch, because you know I love you, baby. Oh, you know I love you, baby, yeah. Now, if I don't love you, baby, I tell you, grits ain't grocery, eggs ain't poultry, and Mona Lisa was a man."
Sure, as you can hear from that, a lot of blues singers use soul music's vocabulary to put their songs across. But underneath, it was the same thing that me and my folky friends had been searching for all along. Furthermore, our seeking out blues and buying records of it by various British bands and the like actually helped revive the flagging careers of some of the older guys. And in at least one case, it resulted in a sizable hit on the pop charts. But the majority of the remaining blues singers who weren't working as revival acts or on the folky circuit stayed pretty close to the South. Despite occasional novelty numbers like the weird Stevie Wonder track we heard at the beginning of this piece, most of the record companies dealing with black audiences preferred to let small independent labels in the South sell funky records with funky themes.
I've got a friend that lives across the street. It must be open house at my house, baby. Lord,
Every now and again, though, blues pops up in the mainstream, as it did at the beginning of this decade. Who knows where ZZ Hill might have taken things if he hadn't died shortly after this hit the charts, in New York of all places, in 1981.
She said your party's jumping and everybody's having a good time, and you know what's going through my mind. Do you mind if I get comfortable
and kick off? Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll.
While you fixing me a train, play me some of them down home blues.
This is Fresh Air. Last weekend, mystery writers from the U.S. and England met their fans from around the world in Philadelphia at the 20th BoucherCon Mystery Writers Conference. One of those attending was one of England's most popular detective writers, Ruth Rendell. Rendell has received the top awards in her field, 3 Edgars from the Mystery Writers of America and 2 Gold Daggers from the British Crime Writers Association. Her first mystery was published 25 years ago. It began a series based on the activities of Chief Inspector Reg Wexford. Rendell also writes psychological thrillers, but I asked her to describe her best-known character, Reg Wexford.
Well, Wexford started off as a very conventional, tough cop, and not a very original character, because I had no idea I was writing a series. Of course, I had no idea I'd created a series character. So he was really an amalgam of other people's detectives. When I found I was with him, stuck with him, he began to change, because I didn't want to be stuck with this tough, rather unimaginative character. And he became more literate, more interesting, more sensitive, more imaginative, better read, and so on. And I think he became more interesting in that way. And he is a popular man. I think people do, men identify with him, and women wish to marry him. Also, they write letters to me and tell me they do. And people see him in relation to his children also. And I think those things have made him, it is as much, in fact, the soap opera aspect of Wexford that has made him popular as his abilities as a detective.
You threatened to kill off Reg Wexford so you wouldn't have to write novels about him anymore. You haven't done that yet, have you?
I didn't really. I never threatened it. I'm afraid that that's a rumour that's got about. I know better than to threaten that. I mean, we know that Conan Doyle did it, and of course Fleming did it with James Bond, and they both had to bring the character back. Well, I don't want to have to do that. It's never very convincing. What I did say was that I would kill him in a book to be published posthumously, you know, that I would have published after I was dead. Which would be another thing. I wouldn't want anyone else to write about him after I was dead.
In the first Reg Wexford novel, there was a woman who turns out to be a lesbian in it. And I think that was a pretty brave thing to write about in 1964, was it?
Well, it must have been 63 when I wrote it. Yes, it was quite shocking to a lot of people. It seems quite funny now, because, of course, I have written novels about lesbians since, who really treating the question as if it was something quite ordinary and usual. But at that time, that first book, it was quite a shocking and exciting thing.
Mm-hmm. I think some heterosexual women writers would be very cautious about, especially in 1963 or 4, about introducing a lesbian character into their fiction for fear that someone would think that they were a lesbian and would therefore discriminate against them, given the amount of homophobia then and now. Did that ever occur to you? Did anyone ever advise you against it because of that, because people thought that you might be the victim of discrimination?
No, they didn't. I thought that the novel was so small and would have such a small readership that it didn't matter. I don't know that I would have cared very much, you know. People assume all sorts of things about you, some things which are very nice and some which are not. I don't know that it matters awfully what you say and do. A lot of people, I mean, I've written another book about lesbians, so a lot of people think I'm lesbian. Well, too bad.
Now, Reg Wexford restores order as the chief inspector, but you write other novels in which the police don't really enter into it. They're not very important in where they figure in, and they're novels more about pathology and about evil, where order isn't restored because there are evil people or sick people or people who have strange psychopathic notions. Why did you write these novels in addition to the Chief Inspector novels?
I find that I get tired of writing one kind. I don't feel that I wanted to spend my whole writing life, which is my life, mm-hmm. writing detective stories. I wanted to write something else that was a bit more interesting. I wrote one which was a breakthrough called The Face of Trespass, of that kind, and I began to write more, and they were the kind of novels I much more enjoyed writing and that a lot of people began to like reading, and I found that it was something that I seemed to know something about.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you know something about psychopathology? I mean, where do you go to find out more? Do you go to textbooks? Do you go observe people on the
streets? Yes, you go to textbooks. I never go directly to life. I have never interviewed anybody in this way or met anybody like that. But you read, and I think that we all have these elements in us. So that if you know what you're looking for and you examine your own feelings, I think that the writer of this sort of book has to do a good deal of self-analysis. I'm sure I do. And I get into my characters and I hope I understand how one would behave if one were like that.
Do you get disturbed ever at what you find when you're introspecting and making connections between you and your characters?
Not anymore. yes, I think I did once, but not anymore. I do find that I find it rather disquieting that there are such things, that elements, because I believe I do understand why people commit horrible crimes without having the slightest wish to do so myself. But I don't think I ever can say, you can't understand how anybody behaves like that, or you can't understand how can he do it. No, I can see why. Perhaps not very fortunately, but I can.
Did it take you a while to admit that you could see why?
Yes.
Why?
Why did it take me a while to admit it? Because if you admit these things in public, I find that people begin very quickly to associate you and identify with you. You know, she says she understands why some brute rapes a woman and kills her and disposes of the body. She must be like that herself. Of course, it is not so. You are not. I think now I don't really care what people think of me in that sort of way, and I'm glad that I can understand it. It makes for better writing. It may make one a more understanding person. I hope so.
I want you to read a passage from your latest novel, which is called The Bridesmaid. And this passage, there's a man and a woman who've fallen very much for each other, but she is... She's very intense and kind of crazy. You can set this up in any further way that you'd like.
He smiled at her and reached for her hand. She withdrew her hand and held the index finger up at him. Some say that to live fully, you have to have done four things. Do you know what they are? I'll tell you. Plant a tree, write a poem, make love with your own sex, and kill someone. The first two, well, the first three, really, don't seem to have much in common with the last. Please don't laugh, Philip. You laugh too much. There are things that shouldn't be laughed at. I wasn't laughing. I don't suppose I'll ever do any of those things you said, so I hope that won't mean I haven't lived. He looked at her, taking a deep pleasure in her face, her large, clear eyes, the mouth that he could never tire of gazing at. When I'm with you, I think I'm really living, Senta. It was an invitation to love, but she ignored it. She said very quietly and with an intense, dramatic concentration, I shall prove I love you by killing someone for you, and you must kill someone for me.
An interesting bargain she tries to make there to prove their love. What kinds of opportunities did this challenge or bargain create for you as the novelist?
Well, it was the crux. It is the crux of the novel. I mean, it is what the novel is about. it's what I suppose it created for me something else that very much an opportunity for something else that very much interests me. That is that about 90% of our lives is illusion. So that especially I think in a love affair, Philip, my protagonist here, lives in illusion. And this fosters more opportunities for illusion. He becomes pretty disillusioned later on. But this gives opportunities for so much confusion and hope and despair and wonder and simply mistakes. All of those things, they're all ingredients in my fiction. Confusion, bewilderment, things going wrong.
You often have surprise twists at the end of your stories. When you're working out the plotting, where does that final twist come in? Is that something you know early on in your planning of the story, or does that come to you closer to the end like it does for the reader?
Well, in the Wexfords, I have a technique. I don't have a technique with the others because I feel that you shouldn't. And the character, the action should derive from character. In the Wexfords, I simply change the perpetrator in the last chapter and go back and work it out so that it surprises me on the grounds that if I can surprise myself, I can certainly surprise the reader. With the others, no. I let it develop out of character, and I'm very glad to say that a twist will usually suggest itself to me at about chapter 18. If that didn't happen, I would be rather upset, I think, but so far it always does.
What's the most risky circumstance you've ever been in, or the most what's the incident that you've experienced in real life that's closest to something that might happen in one of your fictions?
Oh, I do think you ought to have given me notice of that question. I don't know. You see, I'm going to remember all sorts of amazing things in an hour's time when it's too late to tell you.
Shucks.
Yes, it's too bad, isn't it? But I just don't know. I don't think too many things of that kind. And I can't say that I have much personal experience, if any, of violence.
Ruth Rendell, thank you very much for talking with us. Ruth Rendell's new novel is called The Bridesmaid. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing the latest from East Germany, and we'll also be hearing two stories about war heroes of sorts. One, a man whose friends and family thought for years that he was a Vietnam War hero and a former POW. After his death, it was discovered that he'd never even been to Vietnam. And another man who didn't talk about his experiences in the Second World War much, but it turned out that he indeed was a World War II hero, and he may yet be commended for his battlefield heroics.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new biography of the poet Allen Ginsberg by the British author Barry Miles. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
There are several things this biography of Allen Ginsberg isn't. It isn't an act of criticism, a work of scholarship, or a history of the feverish times. I'm not sure Barry Miles is interested in modern poetry and the literary culture that bent, spindled, and mutilated the poet. And he's missed the point of Ginsberg's civil libertarian anarchistic politics. That's the bad news. The good news is that Miles is a British buddy, a kind of superfan, with access to Ginsberg's diaries, an editor who's looked at every piece of paper that ever crossed the poet's desk, a mole in an archival treasure trove, and a wonderful storyteller. We meet the gentle poet father, Lewis, and the crazy communist mother, Naomi. We grow up in New Jersey with a kid whose favorite writer was Poe, whose favorite book was Dr. Doolittle. We accompany this kid to Columbia, where he met and slept with Kerouac, William Burroughs, and Neil Cassidy, where he confounded Lionel Trilling. We smoke his pot when he writes a paper on Cezanne for Meyer Shapiro, when God talks back to him through William Blake, when he ships out with the Merchant Marine. were there on North Beach for Howl, in Tangier for Burroughs, Morphine, and a Machete, in Machu Picchu when God talks to him again after the death of his mother and tells him to love women, in Castro's Cuba where they kicked him out for thinking too much about drugs and homosexuality, in London, Moscow, Budapest, Jerusalem, and Chicago 68, hobnobbing with the Stones, the Beatles, and R.D. Lang, writing lyrics for Bob Dylan and the Clash, turning on Robert Lowell to LSD, phoning Henry Kissinger in the White House, telling Ezra Pound, but I'm a Buddhist Jew, composing Kaddish, loving Peter, hating cocaine, becoming, with a Pulitzer, respectable. It's a portrait of the angel-headed hipster as a social bandit, like Rob Roy, Pancho Villa, and Mac Heath. When the alarm bell rang to end the 1950s snooze, for many it was Elvis, but for some of us it was Ginsberg. Not because of the sex, or drugs, or spiritual push-ups, but because of his other America, an alternative nation of Tom Mooney, Sacco and Vanzetti, the Scottsboro Boys and the Wobblies, all of Moloch's children. If he went away in the early 60s, washed up desolate on a Ganges bank, vegetarian and silent, he returned in time for the levitation of the Pentagon, the convention in Chicago, Judge Hoffman's kangaroo court, Bill Buckley's firing line, ban the bomb, hands off Nicaragua, He was a one-man counterculture, a bridge between the yippie media brats and the new left Little League Leninists in our second Civil War. Like his friend Walt Whitman, this lonely old courage maker nursed our wounds. Imagine a non-violent social bandit like Dr. King and Joan Baez, an incorruptible pacifist even when it hurt, sending up his alms, his toy balloons, against the techno-structured superstate. He emerges from these sports pages as a magical, bandit, subversive nurse, defending the self from a devouring society. The only poetic tradition, he has said, is the voice out of the burning bush. But there's another tradition, equally metrical, mystical, manly, and no less honorable in a dishonest time. There is, he is, the medicine man.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Ginsberg, a biography by Barry Miles. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Penny Hain. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist and gay activist Armistead Maupin talks about the concluding novel in his Tales of the City series. Also, a 75-cent accounting discrepancy led computer expert Clifford Stahl to discover a computer spy ring. We'll find out how he tracked down the intruders. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.